You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Built by NGOs from the UN and from Norway and Sweden and so on, is the situation is literally that the fourth grade students teach the third grade students teach the second grade students, and that's how they operate. There's literally almost nobody amongst them with a college level education. There was one lady I remember who had a college level education which was killed, and it was such huge news because she was like the only one amongst hundreds who had actually been to college. You know, so they really are, as I mentioned, the lowest of the low. You know, there's hardly any amongst them that are educated, and there's hardly any amongst them that are has any professional kind of training in any capacity. So they're completely unable to advocate for themselves.
A couple of points of historical clarification. Bengal was part of British India. Bengal was part of independent India until 1971. There was a war with, it was part of
Bengal, part of Pakistan.
It was East Pakistan.
East Pakistan, yeah.
Sorry for 71. That. And then in 1971, it split off as a separate country, Bangladesh. But the way the British drew the boundary between the Burma part of British India and the India part of British India sort of put the Rakhine state, or what became the Rakhine state, with Burma,
yeah,
rather than with the Bengali part of British India. Did I get that right?
Yeah. The important thing to remember, irrespective of the borders, irrespective of the countries or how the British drew the map, is that these people have been there in that region for thousands of years. Yeah. And one of the things I tried to provide in my book is cast iron proof, you know, that at least it goes back to 1799. Now, most ethnicities will never have that kind of documentation to prove that they're from that region, but I've tried to provide multiple sources, you know, to show that these people have actually been in that particular region, irrespective of what you may call it, you know, whether it's rightly part of Bangladesh, part of Rakhine, part of Burma, part of the Kingdom of Myanmar, irrespective of that. It's that region, they have been there, and they have a right to be there.
Okay. So let's go to the gentleman on the aisle, and then back to the...
Professor, thank you for your talk. My name is Crawford. I'm an intern at the U.S. ASEAN Business Council. One other explanation I've heard
Could you hold the mic a little bit closer to your mouth, please?
One other explanation I've heard for the general lack of silence is that Aung San Suu Kyi is relatively uncertain about how much control she has over the country at this point. The military still has sufficient power. And if you've constructed this narrative where the military has... you know, built up this hatred and, you know, increasing information about what the direness of the situation could disturb the military and could, you know, reignite political conflict in the country. I think that's been mentioned, some things I've heard, as a reason why she wants to, you know, proceed slowly. Do you buy that? And if so, could you comment on if there were to be greater awareness about this, do you think the general populace would swing towards Aung San Suu Kyi, would swing towards the military, or how do you think the populace would play a role in that conversation? Thank you.
Excellent question. You know, it's one of the things I've heard from a number of people is that, look, the simply Aung San Suu Kyi, her power is so fragile that there's simply nothing that she can do at this particular stage. And as I made it clear in my presentation, you know, the military still have, even though there's been elections, you know, they still have considerable power. They're essentially running the show. You know, they control the most powerful ministries. They have the ability to dissolve parliament whenever they want. You know, they're essentially calling the shots. And if Aung San Suu Kyi steps out of line, then, you know, essentially her power will be diluted quite considerably. And I understand that, I'm a realist as well. However, as a Nobel laureate, you know, as an international peace icon, when there is genocide and massacres going on in your country and you're completely silent, or you try to brush over it, or if you say, well, look, both sides are to blame, that is the moral equivalent to me of saying, look, both sides in the Holocaust were to blame, both the Jews and the Nazis, or in apartheid South Africa, or both sides were to blame for what happened. That to me is moral bankruptcy, and it's simply not good enough for you to be in that position, irrespective of whether whether it will dilute your power or not. And that's my interpretation.
Okay, woman on the back row.
Hi, my name is Catherine Southwick. I'm an independent researcher, and I've done some work on the Rohingya. I'm sorry I missed the presentation because I was delayed, but and I apologize. But I just wanted to know if you could speak a little bit more about the impact of the label of genocide on the discourse and the politics in how in the international setting, but also domestically. I've been somewhat surprised and disappointed that I have not seen UN agencies that have a mandate to look into these questions, like the Special Representative on genocide or the responsibility to protect, to really say anything about this situation. And given that a number of academic institutions have been doing extensive studies finding strong evidence of genocide in this case, it's striking to me that it's not penetrating or seems to be having much impact. Thanks.
The term genocide has two different interpretations. There's an academic definition and there's a legal definition. So most of the academic institutions and experts who have looked at this issue have termed it a genocide. I mentioned some of them in my presentation: Yale University, Queen Mary University, a number of other academics and institutions. You know, a number of professors I interviewed for my book. You know, almost half a dozen of them, experts in international law, very prominent individuals. They all basically said this meets the classic definition of a genocide. There's also a legal definition, which is a little bit different. And that is really at the discretion of, member states at the UN. For example, Rwanda wasn't classified as a genocide, because what that means is it automatically triggers the Security Council to take a particular course of action, which at that time the US simply didn't want to do in 1994. So Rwanda was never classified as an actual genocide. I describe the situation in the Rohingya are facing as a slow-motion genocide. But let me just read out to you very, very quickly the definition that Queen Mary University put it. They basically said there's five stages to a genocide. You know, genocides do not happen in a vacuum. It doesn't happen overnight. You know, we think, oh, we woke up to Rwanda, was happening overnight. It takes decades upon decades for the dehumanization process to occur. It takes decades upon decades to do that, for the animosity to build up, and then it's usually a trigger that has it. So the first stage is usually stigmatization of the entire population. So in the case of the Rohingyas, when they're denied their citizenship, you know, they're completely stigmatized. Second stage is harassment, you know, discrimination in jobs, you know, and the boycotts of their businesses, religious persecution. Then it's isolation when they're herded off to camps and then they're completely cut off from the rest of society. The fourth stage is systematic weakening. They have all their identities removed. They're given, you know, white cards that they have to show at all time. They can't travel, they can't move, they can't have children, they can't get married without a license. They can't vote, they can't do anything, essentially. And the fifth stage is usually mass annihilation. Now, I believe the situation and what's happening in Myanmar has completed almost all five of the stages, and what's happening now is a slow-motion genocide that's going on, and that's the description I give in my book. But I also believe that it only take a small trigger now for it to descend into a mass killing, to large-scale massacres. We've seen a taste of those in 2012 and 2013, but to have it on a much larger scale, I think it really is just going to take a trigger to do that.
Right here.
Hi, my name is Kate Flicker, and I'm also a high school student at the School for Ethics and Global Leadership. I was just wondering, in terms of pursuing legal action for the Rohingya under the ICC, Myanmar is actually not a signatory country under the ICC, and although certain exceptions do exist regarding the jurisdiction, it would be extremely difficult to pursue a legal case. But my question is, even if there was a legal case that was pursued under the ICC or perhaps the ICJ, how would that benefit the Rohingya in the end?
You know, you're absolutely right. And one of the things the International Criminal Court can't do unless you're a signatory to the Rome Statute or unless you refer yourself, the country refers itself, to be investigated. In terms of what the ICC can do, and I actually spoke to one of my friends who works at the ICC, is that they can't initiate an investigation without actually taking the necessary legal action against, you know, the individual. They can initiate an investigation, and I think that would be a very positive course of action, simply because the government of Myanmar actually reacts very well to pressure. They actually react, unlike a lot of other governments that engage in this kind of behaviour. As soon as there's something going on in the country and there's, you know, international pressure from journalists and activists and so on, they actually react quite quickly. And I think any sort of an investigation initiated by the ICC against particular kind of individuals that are instigating kind of violence will certainly have a quite a strong deterrent effect. And it's essentially that is the logic behind it. You know, I don't anticipate the ICC, they have no mandate to actually undertake a prosecution of these individuals. They have no mandate to do that, but they can initiate an investigation and highlight what is actually going on in the country. And I think that would actually be quite effective. And there have been a number of precedents for that.
Over here. The mic's coming from behind.
Hello, thank you for your presentation. I'm Adrienne Ginetti here at Brookings. In your field research, did you come across any evidence to substantiate neighboring countries' claims that the Rohingya have ties to terrorism, which they cite many reasons why they don't want to take the Rohingya, but that seems to be one of the ones?
You know, this is one of the main accusations made against the Rohingya, that, you know, these people are, they're terrorists and they're, you know, that they have designs on the state of Myanmar. And it's very interesting when, you know, during the rise of ISIS in Syria, that's one of the things that the government of Myanmar tried to promote, that these people are actually ISIS sympathizers. During my research, I've seen absolutely no evidence at all that they were engaged in any sort of violent activity, simply because these people are so disenfranchised, they probably don't have access to anything that is that can be used for terrorist purposes. And I think they also know that they will be, they'll essentially be wiped out. You know, if they started engaging in a violent campaign, then that will give the government of Myanmar, the military regime, the exact justification that they need to initiate a much larger and more brutal repressive clampdown. During my visit to the camps in Bangladesh, I did hear, and I only heard it from one source, I did hear that there were some extremist groups that were trying to penetrate the camps in Bangladesh. There was one group from Kashmir, from Pakistan, called Lashkar-e-Taiba. And I heard, and once again, it's not confirmed, that they were trying to penetrate some of the camps to try to encourage the Rohingya to get involved in some sort of armed struggle. But they didn't receive much traction at all. They didn't receive much sympathy. I think the Rohingya know that, you know, they have zero ability to actually do it and have zero effect, you know, or be completely counterproductive. But in terms of actual violence, to the invasion, absolutely no evidence at all for any of that at all.
Any other questions? Yes, right there.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Brin. I work at the U.S. State Department in the Office of International Religious Freedom. Thank you very much for your presentation and for your book. I had two questions about, depending on when your research was conducted, this may or may not have come up, but if you could speak about conversations you had related to the citizenship verification process, the pilot program under USDP, and what's currently going on. And then also, we're well aware of the restrictions on their ability to exercise their religious freedom rights, you know, with the violence, the mosques that were damaged and inabilities to either renovate them or rebuild them. But if you could talk about specific examples of religious freedom rights violations that you encountered in your research, that'd be very helpful. Thank you.
In terms of the citizenship law, I'm aware that there was a number of initiatives that were initiated by not just the US government, but also by the European Union, in terms of trying to reintegrate the Rohingya into the citizenship. The main problem, as I mentioned in my presentation, is the 1982 citizenship law, which has to be reversed. You know, but I'm also aware that this can't happen, you know, overnight. It can't happen suddenly. So one of the things I mentioned to the Kofi Annan's team is that there has to be a number of confidence-building measures before something like this can happen, because the prejudice is so now inbred in society. It's so deep in society that a sudden change like this will probably lead to mass riots. So I recommended a number of confidence-building measures, you know, freedom of movement, freedom of having children without having to get a license. Right now they're restricted, Rohingya, that before they can get married, they need to get a license and they can only have two children. and they don't have ability to access to healthcare education. So are some of those measures to try to ease the situation before the citizenship law is actually looked at in its entirety. In terms of religious persecution, even during my trips, you know, I seen there was a number of areas that were completely closed off, you know, where all the mosques and the schools had actually been burnt down, simply because they didn't allow them. The Buddhist extremists simply didn't want them. Yeah, one of the areas I couldn't go to, there was an entire village which had a school, you know, and a high school, a school and a mosque and so on. It was completely burnt out. But I was told by my guide that, you know, there's no way that they'd let you into that. And in many cases, you know, the extreme Buddhist organisations, you know, they will only allow the Rohingya, even the ones that are in the most desperate situation, access to healthcare, to a hospital, if they actually convert on the spot. So that is the most blatant example of religious persecution, religious discrimination.
Yes, sir. Mike's coming.
What in the geopolitics of that part of the world keep two Muslim states, Malaysia and Indonesia, from taking a strong position about this?
Both of these countries, like Malaysia and Indonesia, is the most populous Muslim country in the world. It's the biggest Muslim country in the world. And Malaysia, both of these countries have taken dozens, you know, thousands of refugees, you know, possibly in hundreds of thousands, both of these countries. And there's only a certain amount that they can absorb, you know. And it's a question that I get asked often is that, look, why don't these countries, you know, step in and take more refugees and house them? But that is essentially, this is exactly what the government of Myanmar want. You know, they want all the Rohingya to leave and go into a third country. And that's not getting the crux of the problem. As I mentioned, these people have been there for thousands of years and, you know, they deserve to remain where they're from. It is not the responsibility of any other country to take them in. You know, when they're being, it's the responsibility of the international community to ensure that the persecution stops and these people are full citizens of their own country. And Malaysia, has got many of its own problems. You know, there's only so much that they can do, so much they can absorb. And another factor is, you know, as I've met some of the Rohingya in Pakistan and Malaysia and so on, these people really are, you know, and I've said this a number of times, really are the lowest of the low. You know, they're really just, there's literally very little interest in their well-being. The kind of jobs that they have and the kind of ghettos that they create wherever they go, you know, they really have absolutely nothing. So there's not much interest in them. You know, Bangladesh took hundreds of thousands of these refugees. They created camps for them, they built camps for them. But then even recently, the government of Bangladesh has turned their back on them, you know, and wants them to go back. And the camps in Bangladesh are almost just as bad as the ones in Myanmar itself. You know, but the government of Bangladesh is not a wealthy country, simply can't cater for them and can't provide for them. And has also created a lot of animosity locally in areas like Cox's Bazar and so on, where the refugees are located, that they're coming and taking, you know, local jobs. And the local jobs are just manual kind of labour jobs, but they keep taking local jobs, which is creating tension between them and local populations. But the responsibility is on the government of Myanmar to reverse the discrimination. You know, it's not the responsibility of any other country to take in the refugees or try to solve the refugee crisis.
But I would.
Yeah. But as I mentioned, the ASEAN countries, all these countries are members of the ASEAN initiative. You know, they've tried to put as much pressure as possible on the government of Myanmar to take the initiative to stop the flow of refugees. But the refugees continue to flow, and I don't think there's much that they could actually do. I'm not sure what initiatives they could actually undertake to force the government even more, you know, when the government is hell-bent on trying to expel some of these people.
It does seem that if anybody has an incentive to put pressure on the government of Myanmar, it's these countries that don't have, or are the countries of first asylum.
Yeah.
One last question. Okay, in the back.
Just to end on a more positive trajectory, what do you think is the way forward in terms of where advocacy, effective advocacy for the Rohingya could go? Is it through this UN commission? Is it through, you know, increased international attention and so forth?
I think raising awareness is absolutely critical. As I've said, I've given this presentation, you know, a number of times, and people have absolutely no idea. You know, people, prominent people have told me, I had absolutely no idea about the Rohingya. I never heard the word, and I had no idea this was going on. So a key factor is raising awareness, you know, is absolutely critical. And it's also critical to put pressure on the government of Myanmar. And they do react to pressure. They react actually quite effectively to pressure, unlike many other governments around the globe. And unfortunately, the US has lifted all sanctions on Myanmar, so it has very little leverage in terms of trying to force the government of Myanmar to reverse some of its discriminatory policies. But I think the critical thing is just to try to raise awareness as best as you can. And as I said, that is usually, in many cases, that's the final check on mass killing. It's international opinion, you know, of journalists and advocates and human rights advocates and campaigners that are raising the issue continuously. That's sometimes the only check on a mass killing. So I think that's very important.
Well, I think.